Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 15, your quintessential guide to Quidditch, where we will be talking with author, community organizer, and Harry Potter Alliance member, Caitlin Harper. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Today, we are mixing things up. We have as our special resident expert, Emily Strand, instructor in comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing in Columbus, Ohio. Emily was one of the contributors to Harry Potter for Nerds 2, with a chapter on Quidditch as a symbol set in the Harry Potter series, and that was called The Second War Was Won on the Quidditch Pitch of Hogwarts. Emily is also the author of the book Mass 101, Liturgy and Life. She has been a guest on our podcast and on MuggleNet Academia several times, and we are very happy to have her here as our expert for this special show. Thanks for being here, Emily. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me. This is super exciting. I always love to talk about Quidditch, and so I am very excited to be here.
Fantastic. We're going to have a Quidditch Palooza today. Right?
Yay!
All Quidditch all the time. But before we get into that, Emily, I did notice that you are one of the magical faculty at the Roanoke Generic Magic Festival,
right,
as it is called.
Very generic.
Not Harry Potter oriented.
Nope,
at all.
Not at
TM.
All.
Okay, so I noticed that you are going to be talking about robots and house elves, and I was remembering the Star Wars Harry Potter episode that we recorded together, and I wondered what are you planning to talk about with robots and house elves? Is this related to the Han Solo movie?
A little bit, yeah. So I took this really wonderful class this summer at the Mythgard Institute, taught by Amy H. Sturgis, who is another friend of this podcast, and
absolutely
well-known in Harry Potter scholarly circles. So it was all about science fiction, and I really hadn't read a whole lot of science fiction. So we delved into the history of the genre and read a lot of really wonderful early works. And I was really intrigued by the notion of robots and how it originated in this 1920 play by a Czech playwright called Karel Čapek. And he wrote this thing, and, you know, we think of robots, we think of them as the big shiny robot sort of thing, but that is not really how they originated. They were almost more like clones from Star Wars or androids, where they're like kind of human replicas.
Automatons. Or
exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I did this study of robots for my final paper, and the more I looked at the robots, the more I realized how similarly, house elves in Harry Potter are construed to robots in science fiction, even in terms of like the rules that kind of govern their behavior in the narratives and the kind of ethical concerns that go around the creation of a kind of a dedicated servant class and what that means, and the role, even this was the most interesting part to me, the role of female characters in voicing those ethical concerns were really all very interesting to me, and it just kind of led me to write this paper about robots and house elves. So I'm going to talk about what I found in more detail, and yes, Solo, a Star Wars story, comes into play because we have a really interesting kind of iteration of this.
Yeah, and robot rebellion.
Exactly, led by our only female, significant female droid, L337. So some really interesting different strains in literature and fiction coming together there, and then also in the with the house elves. So
yeah,
but you know, I mean, and I, a couple people I talked to were like, no, that's not cool. House elves are totally not robots. And I was like, dude, if the sock fits, you just, you gotta wear it.
Well, you know, so, I love the house elves. And I definitely think, to me, this is one of the central issues that's so interesting. That question of liberation and, you know, are there natural slaves? And that seems like those are the same kinds of issues that you're dealing with like artificial intelligence or, you know, robots, automatons, all of that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, and just so everybody knows, I did cite Katie's essay about house elves and the elf and mystique, right?
That's
so
right.
The original version. So I actually cited the updated version that's in For Nerds too. But especially when you were talking about the Fountain of Magical Brethren, because that was the piece I used to talk about. House elves really are created servants. They're not, this is not just, these creatures didn't just pop out of the earth ready to serve the wizards. This is a social construct that they really have no say in. Mm-hmm. And so they're just as good as, in terms of being created servants, they're just as much enslaved to the humans as a robot would be because of these social constructs. So your essay came in very handy to.
Excellent. I love that. Take it forward.
Yes.
Take it to the next step. I love that.
Right.
Well, our special guest today, to help us delve more deeply into the question of Quidditch, we're going to take Quidditch further than I hope you have taken it before. our special guest to help us do that today is Caitlin Elizabeth Harper, an author, creative problem solver, community organizer, and wizard activist. She is the director of operations and company culture at Insider Inc., the host of the Renegade Reading Series for Emerging Writers in Brooklyn, a member of the NYDA, which is the New York City chapter of the Harry Potter Alliance, and the author of the young adult novel, It Will Set You Free. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. This is like a dream come true.
Excellent. Well, before we get into the Quidditch, I did want to ask you to describe to us your young adult novel, It Will Set You Free. Can you tell us a little bit about that in case anybody's interested in picking it up?
Yes, everyone thinks it's going to be a magical book because of how obsessed I am with Harry Potter, but it is not. It's plain contemporary fiction. It's about a teenager who moves from Florida to New York and actually hates it, which I really enjoyed writing because I also moved from Florida to New York. And most people who move to New York and do this big move are really excited to be in the city. And I kind of wanted to write a story where someone hated it. And then she kind of finds community in Brooklyn by falling in with this community art center, which is going to get shut down. So then she creates this fun social media plan, like a really entrepreneurial endeavor to save this community art space in Brooklyn. So she uses like all of her skills and intuition and juju to do it. Yeah.
I love that.
Awesome.
That sounds really cool, Caitlin. What I like about sort of just even the little synopsis that you've given is I think like the Harry Potter Alliance, if I can make this connection, it's talking about art and the role of art in creating stronger and better communities. Does that sound right? And I feel
it
like
does,
the Harry Potter Alliance is really doing that same thing.
Yeah, we're actually, I know you and I have spoken about the Granger Leadership Academy before.
Yeah.
And it just was announced that the next Granger Leadership Academy is happening in Philadelphia next spring. So the location was just announced and everyone's super excited and tickets go on sale tomorrow for
the
Granger Leadership Academy. And we're going through like a lot of the alumni trying to figure out, you know, what programming we want to see and everything. And something that keeps coming up is the role of art in activism. And how therapeutic it can be and how it's necessary and how like this is the way a lot of people express themselves. So there are a lot of artists there and it's really nice to see that sort of side of this community building more than just, you know, making protest signs. Like there's real art that's part of activism. So
absolutely.
I think we're going to work on that this year.
That is wonderful. That's just wonderful. And I love the idea that the next generation is coming through with that in their minds as well. Wonderful. All right. Well, let's get ourselves right into talking about Harry Potter as art and maybe Quidditch as maybe also a kind of inspirational source, although it's sporty. So, Caitlin, first, let's lead off with our question. When did you decide that Harry Potter was literature worth taking seriously?
I actually know exactly when it happened. So I was 17 when Order of the Phoenix came out, which was my favorite Harry Potter book up until possibly this year. And now I don't have a favorite, I can't decide. But that was my lifelong favorite Harry Potter book. So I was 17. I was working as a bookseller in Barnes and Noble, and I would read on all of my breaks. Like, we all read on our breaks. No one talked to each other. And I found this book, and it was, I swear, I've tried to find this particular book online now because of internet, and I can't. I don't know what it is, because there's so many books now, and like analyzing, all the literature and symbolism and mythology in Harry Potter. But it was that book. It was like books 1 through 4. What do the names mean? Where does Greek mythology come in? Like, what do the colors mean? And I had gone through high school kind of bringing up Harry Potter to my friends and teachers really tentatively as a subject to discuss, and was shut down at every turn because it's like not literature, right? We read The Scarlet Letter twice, but we couldn't ever talk about Harry Potter.
Do
I
we want
found
people to be
this
readers or not?
book. I know. I was like, oh my God, I can never even think about The Scarlet Letter. It drives me insane. So yeah, I found this book, and it was like talking about Lupin's name and like all this stuff that when I was reading the book and trying to put those labels that I was learning in high school on this book, and I was told I wasn't supposed to. And then I thought that there's this person out there, this author who thinks the same thing as me. And I went home and I was like, I am going to go to college. I was going to go to college in the fall and become an English major and a creative writing, concentration. And I was like, I'm going to become an author, and I'm going to teach a college class on Harry Potter. And my mom was like, that's so cute. And my mom, she is a college teacher, and she was like, that's wonderful. Like, in the future, maybe people will want to talk about Harry Potter with you. But then, like, patting me on the head, like, probably not. And so then I was like, that's why this is so important to me, because I'm like, oh my God, we can talk about Harry Potter in an academic way, and we go to the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference and all that stuff. And no one ever wants to talk about Quidditch, even though it's probably my favorite thing. So now I'm forcing everyone to listen to this podcast about Quidditch.
That's right.
I'm
That's right. I
so
love
excited.
that.
So
Choosing
excited to talk about Quidditch.
the unpopular, the untrendy. Let's make
I
sure people
know.
talk
Oh
about it.
gosh, I know. The readers don't want to read Quidditch, and the athletes don't want to talk about Quidditch, so I'm caught in the middle.
Okay, but Quidditch
Well,
is a phenomenon, isn't it?
it is.
Yeah, and so let me ask you, and this is for Caitlin and Emily, are you guys sporty? Are you interested in Quidditch because it's a sport? Is that what part of the
Interesting.
interest?
Kate, the thing, Caitlin and I have actually already discussed the answer to this question probably last year at Chestnut Hill, because we're coming at this from like exactly opposite perspectives. Like, I actually come, my interest from Quidditch stems from I should say my interest in the symbolic nature of Quidditch stems from my unwillingness to take any sport on its own terms, because I am the least sporty person that you've ever. Well, I shouldn't say that. I like to exercise, and like I like to be fit, but I don't like when you put me in a team for a. It's a disaster. It's just an absolute. And Quidditch is like, especially Muggle Quidditch, that is the last thing on earth I would ever play, because holy. Wow, I've watched a lot of it, and it's not particularly like the safest sport in the world.
No,
And
it's tough.
anytime you're running around with it's like rugby, and also like serious dodge, and then like also you have a stick between your legs,
Right.
so just watch out for that.
I tell
So
everyone, if there was no broomstick in Muggle Quidditch, it would be illegal. Like,
yeah.
the broomstick is the thing holding you back, even though I think it's incredibly dangerous to have a stick like with you. Like, I'm just waiting for an eye to get like poked out. But yeah, if there was no broom and it was just full on contact, co-ed rugby, dodgeball, basketball, like they would have to outlaw it. Like, it's so dangerous.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that I've heard that actually the stick is one of the things that's holding Quidditch back from acceptance by universities and various, you know, club leagues, where they say it's just too dangerous to have that stick.
Well,
but
it looks
saying
ridiculous.
It holds people back.
I think, well, you can't run, and like there's a rule, like you have to keep your hand on the stick and all that. Like, I think it's, I did try out for my birthday 2 years ago. I forced my partner and my most athletic friend. So these are my only two really athletic friends who aren't my sports teammates. And I was like, they were going to throw me a surprise Harry Potter themed birthday, which I wasn't a surprise because I figured it out. And I was like, my birthday will be so much better if we can, the three of us can go and try out for this Quidditch team just as an activity.
And no pressure.
I know.
And it is my birthday. Do it for me.
Say. I know. I was like, you must come. And they were like, we don't want to do this, but it's my birthday. So they didn't make it through the whole tryout. And it was 4 hours long. And it was 95 degrees outside. And it was just like, it went on and on and on. It's the hardest thing I think I've ever done in my entire life.
Wow.
And I play a lot of sports. So, yeah.
You need a Hermione in the stands kind of making things go your way.
Right. I'm like, can you cast a spell and make this horrible dust go away and like do some sort of like cooling charm on my head? But
so,
yeah.
But it sounds like, Caitlin, you are kind of sporty. You've played some athletics.
Yeah. Right now I play Gaelic football and camogie, which are two Irish sports. Pretty competitively. So I go to the North American Championship for camogie every year. It's actually in Philadelphia this year, so I'm going to Philadelphia like four times in the next 6 months. So I play those two sports, but I've always been kind of sporty, which when I started reading Harry Potter, I was like, this, I am Harry Potter. Like, I, the second I read the book, I was like, I moved around a lot as a kid, and playing sports was always the first thing that I did when I got anywhere. So it started when I was really young, and you know, you go to the playground and ask kids if you could join into their kickball game or whatever. That's how I made friends. And then I got older, and every time I moved anywhere, I just joined a sports team. So to read a book where this boy goes into a completely new place and literally joins a team, a sports team, like in a magical world in order to like be a part of it. And then he's also great at it. I was like, I've never read a book that resonated with me more in my entire life than that book. Like,
that's really neat, Caitlin, and I haven't really heard that take on that before, but it is one of those moments where Harry feels, oh yeah, maybe I do belong here, because he's able to fly the broomstick and because Quidditch is something that he excels at, as opposed to all the other things that he has to really struggle with.
Right. He's like, who's Dumbledore? But then, like, I don't know anything about anything, but I can do this thing.
Yeah. And it is his entree into this social network and that feeling of bonding that he has with even getting to know some of the older kids who play. That's really neat. So let's start by, I'm going to ask Emily, because you wrote the essay for the Harry Potter for Nerds 2 book, where you were talking about Quidditch as a symbol set, right? Not as a sport you would want to play. You were really looking at it as this. No, who would want to play a sport? Let's look at it purely as a symbolic function. I shouldn't say purely, because you're looking at other aspects of it too. But you're really very interested in it as a set of symbols that are telling us something about the wider narrative. Can you tell us a little bit about your take on that?
Sure. It stemmed from some discussions I was having with some people, and the initial starting point question had been like, what elements of Harry Potter do you think like just don't work? Like, what do you like not buy?
That's
you know,
a great question.
Potter? It was, and it was really interesting because all these people were chiming in, and like a fourth of all the answers were either Quidditch or had something to do with Quidditch. They were like, this sport is completely bizarre. It's completely quirky. Like, is it a team sport? Is it an individual sport? It's like, it can't decide. So they were like critiquing it on the basis of how it works as a sport. And I was totally confused by that because I don't know anything about sports. So I couldn't really judge it from that perspective. So I, and then I kept saying stuff like, well, don't you guys see how it kind of symbolizes the narrative in the whole, you know? And I was like, I was kind of saying, well, there's seven players and they kind of all, and I had remembered John Granger saying, you know, remarking on the names of the different team members in the, in Harry's first year, you know, Alicia Spinett and the Weasley brothers. And then like everything had to do with a church, Katie Bell, you know, different things that like belong in a church and how that, that symbolism was coming through. And I was like, that's really interesting, but isn't the whole thing, you know, Harry's finding the snitch, he's the seeker, that's his role in the narrative. And they were all like, what? So I was like, well, I guess I'll write this down. So I wrote it down and, you know, so basically, you know, one of the biggest things that I saw in the way that Quidditch acts as a symbol of the larger narrative is the whole two spheres of play. So in both Quidditch and in the narrative, you have two kind of almost separate spheres of play. And this, you know, ironically is one of the things that people have a problem with. But this is one of the most highly symbolic elements. So in Quidditch, you know, you've got the chasers who are scoring on the keepers on the goals, and the keepers are defending them. You've got the bludgers that are zooming around, and the beaters are trying to keep them away from all their teammates. And then in this totally separate sphere of play, you've got these two seekers, opposing seekers, and they're looking for the golden snitch. And it really, none of that has anything to do. They don't score goals. Their whole job is just to look for the snitch. And when they catch it, when one of them catches it, it's 150 points. And that usually always makes their team win the game. And it, of course, it ends the game. And so I was like, you know, this really actually doesn't make a whole lot of sense in terms of a sport. It's like, you know, I read online one reviewer said it's like a game of American football with two people playing tetherball just randomly in the middle of the field, which is a great image. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a sporting point of view, but you know, narratively, it just mirrors what's going on with the larger narrative, where Harry and Ron and Hermione are always having to work at something sort of discreetly in the midst of a larger narrative that's going on. So they've got their own thing going on, and then Harry always has to go it alone at a certain point in the narrative, and it always has to do with the most important task at hand for the wizarding community, which is defeating Voldemort in one way or another. And so it's up to Harry to complete that task, whatever it is, throughout the books, and because everything's really riding on it. And other people can score goals, you know, so like the Order of the Phoenix, you know, they're scoring goals on either side with the Death Eaters, etc. But those are really of a lesser value than the battles that Harry is fighting with Ron and Hermione, but usually it always it comes down to Harry acting on his own. So that was the biggest kind of most convincing thing I saw. But then the more I kind of dug into it, the more I realized that a lot of the players in Quidditch, the roles that they play also mirror the roles that they have in the narrative. And then I started digging in to the alchemical symbolism. And I realized that, you know, with having red Quaffle, black bludgers, gold hoops, and golden snitch. I was like, whoa, that's totally alchemical. So I tied that all up. And then I realized that we needed a white phase, which is what you're talking about, Caitlin, when you're talking about how, you know, Harry joins this sports team and all of a sudden and realizes he's got a talent for this. And all of a sudden he's in, he's like the whatever baggage that he had from having been raised by Muggles, he can drop that now. It's like this period of purification. And again, it's that albedo in the alchemical process. It's that white stage, that stage of purification. I was like, we need white in Quidditch. We need white. And then I realized that he was riding a Nimbus 2000. Hmm. And so she gives it this cloud name, you know, and it's this vehicle of purification for him. And so that kind of tied it all together. So I got kind of nerdy and ridiculous in this essay, and then really Caitlin's taken it and run with it. So
it's not ridiculous. I'm totally on board with it. I think you're absolutely right, and I totally believe that Rowling put all of that stuff in there.
The way that she describes Harry flying as well is totally going on with the alchemical like Nimbus theme, because every time she describes him fly, it's with this completely blissful feeling.
I belong here.
And then he's like literally on a separate plane in the pitch above everyone else. Like, yeah. He is the cloud above everyone else.
And even the little detail that she gives us in the seventh book about how he got a broom, a baby broom from Sirius as a toddler, and was flying around his house, you know, with these great instincts for flight, and that this is what he's drawing on, you know, as he gets on the broom at age 11, having quote unquote never been on one when he actually had, you know, right. and he takes off. It reminds me of when I was seven and my grandpa taught me how to play euchre, you know, and then he passed away when I was seven, and then I never played it again until college. And then all of a sudden I sit down at the euchre table and I'm kicking everybody's butts at euchre. And it was crazy. But it was like, it reminded me, I was like, that was such a gift in that last book to hear about how he had one when he was a little kid. And you know, he had this natural penchant for it. This is so much fun. So much fun.
Note but it's not my... Do not play euchre with Emily.
Yeah, you better look out. I'm like a kamikaze euchre player too. I don't even know what I'm doing. I just move on instinct. It's great.
So, Caitlin, as Emily said, you actually take the... Emily's really drawing the symbol set over the whole arc of the series. And you have really even shown us that in each individual story, the Quidditch that's happening in that book is also sort of mirroring what's happening in the plot and vice versa. So Emily puts forth the idea that Quidditch is kind of like a play within a play, but you are talking about Quidditch as what you call plot mirroring, and you see it flowing both ways, right? That Quidditch is not just mirroring the larger action, but that the larger action is also mirroring Quidditch. So can you tell us a little bit more about why you chose that plot mirroring term as opposed to talking about it as a nested narrative or a play within a play?
Mm-hmm. So I actually thought of this idea when I was listening to the podcast with Emily and John Granger about her paper. And at the very end of the podcast, they are talking about like the parallels and saying that there could be so much more done with this. And they're like, but we all don't like Quidditch. So they don't want to do it. And I think John said, you know, I really wish that someone would go ahead and see how the Quidditch games parallel the story as it plays out. And I was actually on the treadmill at the gym and I like almost fell off the treadmill because I was like, I will do it. I'm gonna do it.
That's awesome.
I was like, met most of my friends who read Harry Potter tell me that they skip over the Quidditch. I'm almost everyone. I'm like Quidditch, 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 like pretty much all the time. And my friends will be like, oh, I just skipped the Quidditch. So, which is why I, for a number of reasons, chose this plot mirroring, because you can't skip over the Quidditch. You can skip over possibly the gameplay. So if it was truly, I think, a story within a story, and that was it, which that's not what I think, right? They're like, oh, I can just skip the games and the plot will go on as is and I'll know everything that's happening. They talk about Quidditch almost constantly. They have the whole symbol set. Emily's talking about all the things about the snitch, like, and then the things that happen in the games. I know these games, and I was like, things that happen in the games happen later in the book. Like, don't you know that? And people are like, I've never, ever read the Quidditch past book 3.
Oh.
And I'm like, like crying. I was like, how is that even possible? So, because the Quidditch in books 5 and 6 is just bananas, because she, J.K. Rowling herself, is getting better and better at, you know, these literary techniques. So to not be reading the Quidditch is just bananas.
And it's so dangerous. Like, things are happening in Quidditch.
I was like, right. What is going on? So in the fifth book, I think I was actually reading the series while I was listening to the podcast, and I was on the fifth book and I was reading it, and there's a part where Harry's going for the snitch and Malfoy's kind of, he's also going for the snitch and reaching for it, and he scratches the back of Harry's hand, and I'm reading and I'm like, seriously, like, J.K. Rowling, this is really lazy, because Harriet had been having these detentions with Umbridge, and he had been writing, I will not tell lies, in the back of his hand. And I was like, she couldn't think of another body part for him to get injured. And then I was like, oh my God, it's not that she couldn't think of another body part, it's that she did it on purpose. Mm-hmm. So then I started looking for all of these little things, right? So I went off just at the start looking for points in Quidditch and in the plot that happened were extremely similar. And the first jump off point I have was injuries, because I remember all of the injuries extremely vividly. Yeah. Because being an athlete, I remember all the injuries that I've ever had and all the little niggly bits that I have and the bad ankle and the bad thumb and all that stuff. And then I thought back to Chamber of Secrets when Harry gets his arm broken by the bludger and then his bones get taken out.
That's very memorable. That,
it is. It's terrible. I was like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. And that arm is the same arm that gets pierced by the basilisk's fang in the Chamber of Secrets. So that was another point where I was like, she did this on purpose. This is a thing that happened in Quidditch, and it's a thing that happened in the greater plot. And it matters more because I know that it happened twice. So if we were skipping all the Quidditch games and just reading about the basilisk, you'd be like, oh, Harry's arm. And I'm like, Harry's arm twice. So I started looking out for these more and more. So yeah, to me, the nested narrative or story within a story or film within a film is more of like a, you know, like a Hamlet situation where there's a specific thing, like the Tale of the Three Brothers is a story within a story, right? It can be read on its own. But I personally, since the Quidditch, and it's not just the games, it's them talking about Quidditch, a lot of the Quidditch that isn't played is just as important as the Quidditch that is played. So when Harry's in detention, you know, or when Ron is jealous, or when Ron is nervous around Hermione because he's also nervous about the Quidditch game, like those are things, it's not happening in the Quidditch game, it's just happening because Quidditch is the most important thing to many of the people in the book. So that's why I use the plot mirror. But the points were there for me.
Yeah, and you know, I think that looking at the sport as this important social factor in the school and all of the ways that it's sort of shaping the relationships among the kids, I think that's also a really crucial dynamic that you can't just, you can't just ignore that by skipping all the Quidditch.
Like when McGonagall gets really invested and Harry's like, I didn't even think she liked Quidditch. And I'm like, everyone is obsessed with this except for Hermione. And she knows more than she lets on because, you know, she and Ginny get in an argument about it later. So yeah, everyone knows something about Quidditch.
So one of the things I really like about what you've talked about, Caitlin, on this sort of following the particular Quidditch game in the particular Quidditch book is that you see not only that the game mirrors the story, but that the story can sometimes on the opposite side mirror the game. So sometimes you'll see something that happened in the game that happened in the story first, as opposed to vice versa. So can you give us some examples of that influence going the other way, or that flow or mirroring going the other way?
Yeah. So the first like fake Quidditch that ever happens is when Harry accidentally plays a sort of Quidditch when he catches Neville's Remember-All. So that is a kind of Quidditch that happens. We don't even know what the snitch is. We don't know what Quidditch is at that point. We don't know anything about Quidditch. And Harry ends up playing Quidditch. And then because he does this Remember-All snitch catch, he's suddenly the seeker on the Gryffindor Quidditch team, the youngest player in a century or whatever. So that was the first like plot thing that happened first. And then the Quidditch followed. Also in Sorcerer's Stone, like Harry catches the Sorcerer's Stone at the end of the book in his pocket. So he didn't mean to catch the Sorcerer's Stone. He caught it by accident, which is the same thing that happens when he catches his first snitch ever in his mouth. So he didn't mean to catch that either. And then that's, of course, the snitch that shows up a lot later. So there's all sorts of things like that where I'm like, those are not Quidditch events, those are just plot events. I don't know, in the second book, Lockhart casts a spell and it causes damage to his brain. He also, you know, casts a spell and does damage to Harry's arm. That's another way that we see Lockhart being an incompetent teacher, which we don't really know. So when he does the spell and takes all the bones out of Harry's arm, we see him be incompetent earlier with like the Cornish pixies and everything. That's the first time we see him actually cast a spell that completely backfires. And that was, for me, the moment when I was like, this Lockhart guy is a complete and total fraud, which then, of course, he reveals to the boys when they're down in the Chamber of Secrets and then ends up obliterating himself. So it's like things like that, yeah, that have nothing really to do with the Quidditch at all, were parallels that I found.
Yeah, and so what do you think it means that sometimes the referencing is flowing both ways? So that, you know, having seen something happen in Quidditch, we might expect it to happen in the plot, but also vice versa, having seen something happen in the plot. We might expect it in Quidditch. Like, why does she do that? Why does she entwine them the way that she does? What should we take from that?
I think it's a lot, has a lot to do with her method of doing ring composition as mm-hmm. well, which when mm-hmm. I was reading it as a younger person, that didn't, I didn't know exactly what ring composition was, right? That was something I also learned on the Harry Potter Academic Podcast. And when they, I think it was probably John again, explaining what ring composition was, I was like, that can't be right. Like, that's too much to do. Yeah. Like,
I get that reaction from people, too. Like, no, you're just reading this in.
I know. Like, this is crazy. This is, like, a bar above and beyond anything I learned in school. And then, like, why would... I mean, in grad school, we talked about, like, authors who were setting out to write literature using those sorts of things, right? But then I was like, there's no way this woman did this. But she did. So I think since... She did want Quidditch to be such a big cultural aspect of the book. Mm-hmm. And it is intertwined. I mean, it happens with other things too. Like, things that happen in a potions class will also happen in a different time. Or, like, interactions with Snape will happen, like, later on with a different teacher. So she uses those things, those ring composition, but she doesn't like to overlap. So since Quidditch is such a big thing, it's natural that something that happens later on in the book would happen earlier in Quidditch or vice versa, because she, I'm sure, I mean, she has these lists. She has, you know, the Quidditch list, the class list, the interactions with Hagrid list of events that happen, and they're all, like, intertwined. Like, she has mirroring all through the book, and it's because of the ring composition of the chapters and then the ring composition of the books as an entire series.
And she's putting it together like a puzzle in a way that it gives you coherence, and it's also directing you towards central themes and those kinds of things, so that Quidditch yeah. really is an instrumental part of what the books are trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm. You know, and let me throw this out there. This may be a controversial statement, and I'm going to need to get our friend B. Groves to help me locate what interviews that I've heard her say this in. But I have heard her say... I think that she did not enjoy writing the Quidditch. That she knew she needed a sport because of what sports do in a society. They kind of, they're that one of those things in a society that causes people to congregate, and it causes them to kind of share an identity, even if it's sometimes an identity in opposition to one another. They're still in opposition, doing the same thing, you know. So it's something that is kind of identity shaping, and it's people rally around it. People work out. You know, I've heard other scholars say sports are this place where we sort of work out our tribalism, you know, in a safe way, in a way that's not violent toward one another.
And you know, she's, as somebody who was doing kind of a parody of those school days novels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sports is always really important in those boarding school stories that were a part of the British, you know, tradition.
Absolutely.
Of boy novels. And so she kind of knows she has to have that.
Exactly.
Your quote about the, you know, the Quidditch the pitch of Hogwarts.
The original quote was like, it was like the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was, I can't remember who said that. And I think it's been like kind of wrong.
Duke of
attributed.
Wellington is who they say,
yeah,
but then there's some
right.
iffy things about whether that would be possible.
Exactly. Right. Cause he apparently hated Eton or what, I don't know. Anyway, it seemed like an unlikely quote, but the spirit is, you know, there in those school days books, you know, where this idea that you have sport as this kind of practice ground for your contribution to society in the larger world, you know, and basically your role as somebody who administrates the empire, you know, in life after Eton or wherever you went. So yeah, I mean, I think she was kind of like, she knew she couldn't write this story without a sport, but that's not to say that she really wanted desperately to write a sport. Cause I don't know if I'm just taking this unfairly, but she doesn't seem like that sporty of a person either. So I don't know. Maybe she
no, is. I've read that too. She's like, I hate sports. I don't care about this. And I knew that my world needed one. And I think this is why when people say they stopped reading it after the third or fourth book, it really irks me, because I think the way she wrote about Quidditch changed. I think she probably came to terms with Quidditch a little bit more, because in the first three books, there are chapters dedicated to Quidditch. There are entire chapters that are, this is the Quidditch game chapter, which right. is why I think people thought that they could skip it. There's a lot of practices where they just go to practice and she tells you what they're doing at practice. And you're like, I was like, even I'm kind of bored with this because no one wants to watch someone practice. Like, that's boring. Right. But then after the fourth book on, it becomes so much more nuanced and entwined. And that's more where you see the dynamics of the teams working outside of the pitch, outside of the games. But I think she does a lot of things. She's like, here's the class. Here's the game. Here's Dumbledore talking to everyone. Here's this. And from the fourth book on, the books get longer. The books get more right. intense. There's a lot more introspection from Harry. So he's thinking. We're in his head a lot more. It's not just like what Harry's seeing. It's what Harry's feeling, which because it's one of those books that, you know, as you grow with Harry, her writing gets better. You know, the world gets more complex. So I think that I would love to hear, maybe not now, but I would love to have heard, yeah, her mention Quidditch, talk about Quidditch at the very start, talk about Quidditch midway through writing, and then hear what her relationship with Quidditch at the end. Because obviously, like, it is the end. The snitch was... Right. opening at the close. Like, I was shocked when I started reading more and more and more Quidditch happening in the books, because I said, I was like, I thought this woman hated this stuff. Like,
yeah,
she's, for someone who doesn't like sports, she's writing about sports an awful lot.
And in that final duel, Harry catches the wand.
Oh my gosh. Like, with the unerring snitch. Skill of a seeker.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's fully embraced it. And if you think about, I know, Emily, I directed you to this on the original Pottermore site. One of the first yeah. bits of additional writing, kind of as an epilogue, that she wrote was this Rita Skeeter at the World Cup in whatever year it was with older Harry and Jenny, and it was little gossipy things about them.
Yeah.
And she based that in Quidditch. It was yep. a Quidditch match.
Yep. And the same themes apply. I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, I mean, I kind of wonder, for somebody who isn't sporty and who doesn't relish in all these sporty details, and it's like pulling teeth to try to write this stuff convincingly, because, you know, you'd have to have a certain level of detail for it to be convincing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for her to do that, you know, she's probably sitting there wherever she writes, you know, at her little coffee shop with her little sheet of paper and her cappuccino, whatever she's drinking. And she's probably sitting there thinking to herself, what the hell do I put in this? You know, like, what do I put? And so, you know, for somebody who's as detail oriented and who writes so symbolically, it was probably natural for her to say, well, let's make it symbolic of what's going on elsewhere. Like, let's, you know, that's going to fill in quite nicely, you know? And then, but you're right, Caitlin, I think as the story progressed, and as Quidditch went from this little thing that she probably has to have to make it all believable, it just grew in significance and grew in significance until by the seventh book, you're right, like, there's this line between what's Quidditch and what's real life has sort of dissolved almost. And mm-hmm. so you have Harry carrying around this golden snitch, and you have him seeking Horcruxes like the seeker he is. And yeah, I mean, it's just kind of fascinating to think about how it might have evolved. I'd love to ask her, like, at least 10 questions about Quidditch, just in general.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And nobody asks her really about Quidditch now.
Yeah. And all these people that skip it.
Yes.
Right. Well, all they talk about is the scoring, right? And she said herself that she's terrible at math. So I feel like the greatest downfall of Quidditch is the seeker's scoring structure.
The 150 points.
That is, I mean, so the game, people say the game makes no sense. So every time we have the game makes no sense argument, I tell people to close their eyes and imagine a game in which there are 9 players aside, and in the offensive scoring section of the team, all the teammates take a seat in a dugout, and one person goes up to bat and strikes out, and then a second person doesn't strike out, and a third person doesn't strike out, and then the whole team switches to defense. Like, and then people were like, what is that? I'm like, what? It's baseball. Like, it's baseball. Right. How does that
also
make
no sense?
Right. How does that make any sense?
And
I'm like, whoa, when you put it that way. I'm like, I do put it that way, because that's literally what, like, you say Quidditch makes no sense. I'm like, baseball is unfathomable. The only, like, sports that make any sort of sense in historical team versus team perspective are things like soccer, where it's literally just a team versus a team trying to score a goal. So Quidditch is more in the vein of, you know, American football, baseball, like these insane sports that someone did invent relatively recently.
Yeah.
In Muggle Quidditch, I think they did reduce that to like 30 points instead of 150.
Right, because it's just madness.
It doesn't make for great sport, but it makes for fabulous symbolism. And that's the thing I've always wondered what it would be like to talk to Muggle Quidditch players. And not, I'm not at all interested in like taking the wind out of anybody's sails, because I think it's super awesome that they play Quidditch, and I've watched enough Quidditch matches to have great respect for the athleticism that goes into it. But I would love to like talk to Quidditch players about the symbolism of Quidditch, you know, in Harry Potter, and like if that, like, does that change anything about your relationship to the sport? Like, I mean, maybe I'm just completely, again, I'm totally non-sporty, so they'd probably be like, no, we haven't even read Harry Potter. We just like to play.
Now, okay, I'm going to try to do this just like John Granger and Emily did it at the end of that other podcast. Somebody needs to do that project. Somebody needs to go and interview Muggle Quidditch players and talk to them about what are they thinking about, and how does it interact with their understanding of the Harry Potter novels? And, you know, what I think, to me, that would be fantastic study. I'd totally be all
over
that.
Or maybe even, absolutely, and maybe even if some Muggle Quidditch players would like to talk about it. I think it would be super fun to have a conversation with Muggle Quidditch players about the symbolism and, you know, yeah, I mean, I think it would be really great to have that kind of an episode someday where you talk about Muggle Quidditch and what it's like to play Muggle Quidditch and, like, you know, because I spoke to a few. I have a video, a little short, I call them Potter postcards, that I post on, that I've posted on Hogwarts Professor. And I did one on Quidditch where I did try to talk to some Quidditch players just because this whole thing interested me. And it was interesting to see that several of them, like, Harry Potter, being a Harry Potter fan was pretty low on the list of like things you gotta be to be a Quidditch player. You know, so like some of them, like one woman I was talking to, one young woman who's I think she was a student at one of the Ohio schools, and she was saying, yeah, you know, we, a lot of people like Harry Potter on our team, but like a few people like haven't even watched the movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, you didn't even mention the books, you know, like whatsoever, you know. So it was, I mean, maybe that's just partly generational, but then also I found it, I was like really surprised, because I thought these people would be all big, huge Harry Potter nerds, and it wasn't. They were more like these people who just like interesting sports, you know?
That's really interesting.
There are a lot of people like that, or like we'll be like, oh, what's your house? And they're like, I don't care. I'm like, oh, I am house, I don't care.
I was like, this is only the single most important question of your entire life, and the way that other fans introduce themselves to each other. Like, and they're just like, whatever, man, whatever Harry Potter is. And I'm like, OMG. Like, how is this? I mean, also me, yes, I am that weird Gryffindor book nerd, but hence the Quidditch paper and the Quidditch interests. But yeah, some of them are just not even there for Harry. They're there for, you know, bashing people in the face with a dodgeball.
It's a violent sport. It's a violent sport.
Why not?
Now, Caitlin, you had, when we sort of talked a little bit about this, but I think in your analysis, you talk about that there are certain books where the Quidditch metaphor, the Quidditch mirroring is stronger and more pronounced than in others. And you've actually already talked about a kind of evolution in the way that she represents Quidditch, and she's talking about Quidditch in the first few books versus the kinds of things that are happening in book five, book six. How do you see that difference? Do you think that the Quidditch is actually more important earlier, later? Where is it? Which books would you say it's actually most important in?
So, yeah, I think, going off what I said earlier, I do think in 1, 2, and 3, there is this very, like, plot line for plot line, like Sirius Black is assumed to be a dark wizard, and the firebolt that he sent was assumed to be cursed. Like, those sorts of, like, here's a line that I can draw between these two things, right? So those are the first three books. And then no one who doesn't want to talk to me about Quidditch, which is everyone, wants to hear about those things. So my favorite, like, Quidditch metaphor, this is what I call, like, my cocktail Quidditch pitch.
I love that. Cocktail Quidditch pitch.
So someone's like, oh, Quidditch. And I'm like, ah, I am a, you know, amateur academic Harry Potter scholar
like specifically about Quidditch, people were like, I don't even know what you're saying. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the fourth book, the plot of the fourth book. That's one of the most popular fan favorite books and one of the most popular fan favorite films. Mm-hmm. And because it has the Triwizard Cup in it, like a lot of people remember it. So I think that's one of my favorite little like tidbits to go through. So that book also, this is going again with the ring composition. So the first three books you have kind of chapter by chapter, point by point going along. The fourth book is the crux of the series, and then it itself is split into two. So the first part is all Quidditch. So a lot of people are like, I skipped that too. And I was like, it's half the book. So that's half the book. And then the other half of the book is the Triwizard Tournament. So in the first half of the book, Harry is still a child. He hasn't yet been chosen for this Triwizard Tournament. We're not in the second half of the series yet. He goes to the World Cup. This is his first foray into the wider wizarding world. So just like playing Quidditch for the first time, this time he's not playing Quidditch, he's watching. But this is the first time that we see international wizards, and we see 100,000 wizards in a stadium, and we see the Ministry of Magic doing all their stuff. We see the Death Eaters come back. We see all this stuff happen at the Cup. And then Harry is very content to go into his year at Hogwarts, again, being a spectator. He wants to keep doing this spectator role, which he's never really had before. Like when Victor Krum is there, no one's looking at Harry Potter anymore. And Harry's really excited to have this year ahead of him where he gets to watch. And then his name is pulled from the Goblet of Fire. No. So then there's no Quidditch for the rest of the book. But then my Quidditch cocktail pitch is that there actually is symbolic Quidditch because Harry plays some Gryffindor. Every single season, their schedule is Slytherin, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw. And regardless of whether we see any of those games played or whether Harry drops out or he's in the hospital wing or whatever, that's the schedule that Gryffindor is supposed to play. So very often the games are canceled or, you know, the monster escapes from the Chamber of Secret. Like, things happen. So, you know, bad things happen. I don't know if you know. So Harry goes back to Hogwarts, and the format or the order in which he does the Triwizard Cup challenges are a season of Quidditch. So he plays Slytherin first by going against the dragon, which is obviously like a serpent. And he catches the golden egg, which is the snitch. Harry always catches the snitch when he goes up against Slytherin, and he always wins every time he plays them. So he goes up against the serpent and catches the snitch. In the second Triwizard Tournament challenge, it's the Hufflepuff challenge. So he takes Gillyweed, which is a Professor Sprout, you know, Hufflepuff plant. And then he goes under the water to save his friends. So it's a very Hufflepuff-esque challenge. Mm-hmm. He's also kind of dopey, which is sometimes seen as a Hufflepuff trait.
We're going to have Hufflepuff fans who aren't going to like that.
The board's lighting up.
It's not me. It's just totally canon. No, it's fine.
But, you know, so, Hufflepuff Cedric Diggory gives Harry the clue in that one, right?
He does. He does.
Right,
he,
so true.
He is Harry's, like, friend and try... Well, he doesn't help him very well.
Not much of a hint.
Right. And Harry says that. He's like, I told you dragons and you told me to take a bath. This is ridiculous.
Not a fair trade.
Thanks, Cedric, for nothing. So, yeah, he goes and saves the friends, and he does the silly but noble thing of saving people that he didn't need to save. So he does that. And then the third Triwizard challenge is, of course, the maze, which is the Ravenclaw challenge. So he has to make it through the maze. He faces the Sphinx, has to solve the riddle, which he also has to do later on to get into Ravenclaw Tower in the seventh book. So, well, he's with Luna, and she kind of does it. So he does a Slytherin, a Hufflepuff, and a Ravenclaw game in the Triwizard Tournament. So when I tell people that at cocktail parties, because that's what when I'm drinking, that's the thing where everyone's like, oh, that's cool. And then they kind of turn away and like run in the opposite direction.
No, that makes total sense. Never thought about it that way.
Yeah, that's a really good spot.
And
I like
especially since there's no Quidditch in the school year. But as you say, the Quidditch World Cup is huge. And I love what you said about how Harry is a spectator and also a child, but then the Triwizard Cup, you know, is supposed to, he's not supposed to be able to be eligible because he's a child. Yeah. And yet he is, and he does end up having this really horrible but maturing experience. In the end of that book.
Yeah. And I would, it's all downhill from there forever.
I know. Then you got book five. It's all caps Harry in book five, right?
No, I think I would just want to pile on with Caitlin and say, I also think Goblet of Fire, you know, ironically, is one of these most Quidditch, important Quidditch texts in the series. And partly because of what he sees at the Quidditch World Cup, which is Victor Crumb catching the Snitch, even though they are not sufficiently ahead, or sufficient, their score is not sufficient to cause them to win the game. Because, and Harry like reflects on this, and says, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And at the same time, Harry says, no, it does make sense. Because, or somebody else says, it doesn't make any sense. And he says, no, it does. He wanted to win this game on his own terms. He knew he could catch that Snitch. And even though his team, you know, couldn't get them there, they couldn't get there, he won on, or he went down on his own terms. And, you know, ultimately, this is something he reflects on later when he realizes that it's not about, sometimes it's not about winning the game. It's about going down on your own terms and holding your head high and walking into that forest of your free will, you know, and you're not going to walk out of it, but you went in there on your own terms.
And, Emily,
and those terms were defeat of Voldemort.
Emily, you're talking about The Deathly Hallows, which is another book where there's no Quidditch match.
And yet so much Quidditch.
So Caitlin, your argument is that by the time we get to Deathly Hallows, even though there's not a Quidditch match per se, that the Quidditch action, the Quidditch metaphor, and the plot of the whole series have flowed together at this point. And so if you could just tell us, how do you see that working? And, you know, and do you think, is that necessary for that culminating plot mirroring that you're talking about?
I think it is. So this is where I think J.K. Rowling had to have come over to the dark side and become at least a mind athlete, if not a real athlete, because... So at the start, like, Harry, Ron, and Hermione are at the Burrow, and they keep trying to, like, quote-unquote, practice for this thing, right? They keep trying to meet, and Molly Weasley keeps trying to break them up by doing these chores for Bill and Flora's wedding that's coming up. And it very much reminded me of, you know, when Gryffindor has the Quidditch pitch booked and Snape rebooks it for Slytherin, or Harry gets detention. Like, he was basically people tried to stop Harry playing Quidditch at every turn, right? They locked up his broom, he was too young, all this stuff. So they're trying to practice for this Horcrux hunt, which is the Quidditch match, and they keep getting stopped. When the wedding is going on and everyone's kind of having a great time, and Kingsley Shacklebolt's Patronus comes and says that the Ministry has fallen, Scrimgeour is dead, and the Death Eaters are coming. Whenever I read that, I literally hear a whistle in my head. Like, that to me is the start of this game. It's like when the crowd's just like chatting, the whistle blows, and the game is going. And then, of course, the trio disapparates like immediately, and that's where the two spheres of play come in. But it is layered because Harry is obviously a seeker, but he's also the Snitch. So Voldemort is trying to catch the Elder Wand, and he's also trying to catch Harry. And Harry is trying to catch the Horcruxes, but he's also kind of going after the Deathly Hallows. And if you read the Quidditch, this is another thing, if you read the Quidditch games, in almost every single Quidditch game, Harry gets distracted from catching the Snitch at some point. So he's either looking at Ron in the goal, or, you know, the Grim is there, or something is happening.
Dementors.
He's at someone. Yeah, Dementors come, right?
Trying to suck out his soul.
A little distracting. You
know, dies several times, right? So he gets distracted in every single game, and he always comes back to the Snitch. So whether it's because he gets hurt. So that's the thing. If he gets distracted and doesn't go back to the Snitch,
he's actually out of the game. So he gets so injured that he is taken out. Hmm. So only in the games when he gets distracted and comes back are the ones that he wins. So that was a huge parallel for me when I was reading it. And I was like, oh my God, this kid is going after the Deathly Hallows. Like, he needs to get back on track. And then he finally does, right? Because he has this awakening after Dobby dies that he has to choose and do this thing because Dobby died. So something terrible happened that snapped him out of being distracted, and now he knows exactly what he has to do. Yeah. And then he goes forward, and the action kind of accelerates a lot from there. So they're in the forest, they're in the forest, they're in the forest. Dobby dies, and then it's like bank, school, woods, like just 200 pages of near death terrifying action. And you said the whole the spheres of play thing is awesome, where they keep kind of having these contacts, like when they hear Dean Thomas and everyone outside the barrier of where they're camping, they're so close,
right?
But they don't touch, and then they finally do touch, and you know, the snatchers coming is like them getting hit by a bludger, and it's taking them out of the game for a second. So it the whole time felt like a Quidditch game to me, because I've been conditioned after reading 6 books of Quidditch to how a Quidditch game was played from Harry's point of view. So you're going at it as a player, as a seeker, looking, trying to seek, trying not to get hurt, you know, knowing that you have to catch a snitch, but you can't make this decision to catch the snitch. And Harry says that as well. He's like, Dumbledore wanted to slow me up. He didn't want me to go all in and do this thing, because he knew that there were things that had to get done before I caught this, before I, you know, killed Voldemort. Just like you could go all in and catch the snitch, but he tried to go on and kill Voldemort, and it didn't happen, right? Like, twice. So now they're in the game. He can't kill Voldemort / catch the snitch until a certain number of things are done, until we score enough points.
Right.
And then we can catch the snitch and end the game.
Right.
So I think it the whole time, just reading it, thinking that this woman had finally come to her senses. True Quidditch fan, like she always was supposed to be.
And you know, it's I'm thinking about this now, about this kind of blurring of the line between reality and Quidditch, and how, you know, throughout the entire book of Deathly Hallows, almost from when he gets bequeathed that snitch until he enters the forest, he does not know why he's carrying that thing around. And it's like he doesn't even, throughout the series, he doesn't understand the significance of the Quidditch that he's playing. And the reader maybe doesn't even understand the significance of the Quidditch that's being played and how it presents these mirrors of the plot, you know, and these mirrors of the plot and this kind of overarching symbolism of the entire narrative. And so then in that moment when he realizes that he's got to go, that he's going to have to offer himself up, that's when he realizes how this thing works. What and what's inside him, what's inside it, is really just something that's like, that reminds him of his own belonging, that reminds him of his own belonging in this community, which kind of takes you back to that first, you know, that first moment on the broomstick where he realizes that he belongs in this wizarding community because of this sport. So I don't know, that's just,
and of course
I love it.
That's what's in the snitch, right? Is his community, and a community of people who have passed beyond the veil, of course.
Right.
That
right.
is maybe a new community that he thinks he's going to be entering into potentially. Yeah. Now, I'm also really interested in the relationship between sports and war, and particularly, you know, Quidditch as maybe, you know, serving some role in wizard war. Emily's title for her chapter in Harry Potter for Nerds 2 was "The Second War Was Won on the Quidditch Pitch of Hogwarts." That play on the quote from the Duke of Wellington that was about the Battle of Waterloo and the Napoleonic Wars. And so it's possible that Quidditch itself is as a sport, a preparation for wizard war. But then there's also been a suggestion that in the modern era, sports is actually a replacement for war in modern life. Emily, you had talked about, you know, tribalism and that team spirit, and and you think about the Olympics, right, as a way to say, we don't have to go to war with each other, let's just race against each other, that kind of stuff. So my question to the two of you is whether you think that this mirroring that Quidditch is doing within the story, is that supporting the idea that the sports are a replacement for war or preparation for war, or is it maybe serving a different role?
Well, that's what people say sports arose out of, was preparation for war, or like people had to prove themselves in sport before they could be soldiers, and then that's how they stayed physically fit. Mm-hmm. I think a replacement for war in modern life, we do have to remember that there are people at war still all over the world. So I do think it's modern life, uh-huh, as a Westerner, you know, and we're, yeah, thinking about war as like two warring bodies kind of going against each other on a battlefield, which does still happen. But I do agree that in our modern, you know, Western life, there's no draft, you know, in the United States. Like, there are soldiers that go to war for us, and they do it in a very different way. So the people who don't have to go to war, maybe it is. That's the way that we, you know, take sides or battle each other or keep, you know, mentally sharp and physically fit and all that. I think it is interesting that, like, for me, I'm not a soldier. And for me, reading the parts where Harry was flying, and that piece that he had when he was flying, that is more similar for me to the way that I feel when I play sports. I get a very, like, one-track vision, and I'm not stressed, and I'm doing a lot of physical activity and often getting hurt. But I have this very, like, blissful, kind of energetic, endorphin-driven feeling, which I don't think, from my reading of war, is what people feel when they're at war. So I think that in J.K. Rowling, particularly, I mean, she's the author, right? Like, she's not an athlete, and she knows a lot about war, particularly in a historical standpoint, but as far as I know, is not in any way a soldier. So I think it is this kind of historical perspective, huh, that you're preparing for war. And she studied the classics and everything, so the fact that Harry prepares for war and then kind of goes off to war in a way and uses the tools, because it's all about Quidditch, uses the tools that he developed in Quidditch to go to war, I do think that that was a parallel that she drew on purpose. But I think it's very nuanced in our modern society about whether in any way, you know, someone who plays soccer that I know would be a good soldier or is like preparing for anything. I feel like, yeah, in our modern society, people have elevated sport to a different level that's gone beyond, you know, this like hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, you know, I think what you're suggesting there is absolutely right. Like, I'm really asking two different questions there, because on the one hand, it's, you know, is Quidditch serving that role, and is that something that sports have historically done? And then there's the question of whether sports are serving that role currently in today's society. And of course, right, you do have people who are competing against each other in competitions like, you know, the World Cup and the Olympics, yeah, whose countries are hostile to each other and may be engaged in warfare with each other. So it doesn't necessarily replace or subsume the actual violence of war.
Right. Yeah. But I do think that there is something to this idea, you know. I heard a biologist, E.O. Wilson, talk about this one time.
Yeah, he's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about how, you know, sports being like the tribalism thing, but also like kind of ritualized benign warfare, mm-hmm, you know? So, and that always interests me because my area of expertise is liturgy, is Catholic liturgy. So this idea of what we ritualize being this very essentialized act that puts us not just, it's not just a reminder, but it's something wherein we can experience something much more profound, and in a kind of a safe context, you know? And so for him to use that term, that really struck me, because that affected the way that I look at Quidditch, because I come at everything with regard to literature in this kind of sacramental sense, and in, you know, I don't just think of things as like symbolic, but rather as sacramental, in that especially in Harry Potter, it kind of seems to point, these little details that she adds seems to point to this larger thing that's much more profound, mm-hmm, and in this overarching way says something about the life of God, you know, and this becomes very
spiritual. All the realities in Harry Potter become very spiritual for her. So in that sense, that's part of what kind of influenced me to look at Quidditch in that way in the first place. And I do think, you know, but so much of what you said earlier, Katie, when you brought up the British school story tradition, I think that's such an important, because like, Caitlin, you're so right in terms of the way we define war these days has totally changed. But in the world of the British school story, it was still pretty textbook, you know, battles and, you know, this type of thing, more kind of a more formalized institution. And I definitely think that in those stories, I think that's what we have to look to. Those stories really had sport as an element of not only a training ground, but also a metaphor for sport in the larger world. And she really is drawing quite nicely on that tradition.
Yeah, I do think it is. I mean, you can see that now even with, you know, countries that have historically been at war who are no longer at war are sometimes more invested in their sport teams when they play each other. You know, like mm-hmm. if the United States plays England or if England plays France, like...
Ireland.
Right. Ireland, yeah. People get really invested in those games because their countries, while they're not, you know, at war at the time, like have a history of competition with one another, and people kind of, you know, are still on some level invested in the outcomes of those mashups. And right. I mean, sports are, you know, it's nationalism, it's patriotism, it's whatever. People get into it, you know, people who don't ever care about, never would wear a flag on their face or anything, show up to the World Cup with flags drawn over their cheeks, and I'm like, what is happening, like, all of a sudden today? So it's like, it is infectious in a way that I think that's also mirrored in war. Like, people say that, you know, being a part of a team and like the way that people go through, you know, army training, like become like a cog in a wheel that needs to function as a team, right? And that is a very like essential part of being on a sports team. I mean, I've had pep up talks where I'm like, oh my god, this is intense, like for like a Gaelic football game, and I'm like, are we gonna kill the other team, like what am I supposed to punch her, like I don't know, like you're making me feel like I'm, you know, supposed to take this girl out, and then an hour later we're like go get beer with them, and I'm like, I think I still hate her, I don't know.
So, I'm just really interested in this whole idea that it's, you know, it's a kind of ritualized war that is a substitute or a standing in, but can also simultaneously be a practicing of, and
preparation
that
for.
As a ritual, it is actually taking you to the same kind of mental space, or it's supposed to, you know, reveal larger transcendent ideas and maybe even the divine. I love this idea of like sacred Quidditch. Let's coin that term.
Right. Well, you know, that golden snitch. I mean, the alchemical stuff that goes on with Quidditch is really interesting. You know, the red phase being the resolution of opposites, you know, and that's, you know, of course you take the quaffle, which is red, and you score on the other team. So the resolution of opposites. So you're scoring on each other. And then the black being that disorientation phase, you know, that stripping of all that is, you know, clouding you. So the bludger is there to just bludgeon you into unconsciousness if you're not paying attention, you know. And then the golden phase is that phase of final transformation, that divinization, you know. And so the goal, of course, you can win through scoring on the hoops, which are golden, or you can win by catching the snitch. Usually some combination, you know, and that's what finally ends the game and transforms the winning team into the winning team. So it's, it's highly symbolic, and it's highly, to me, it's highly sacramental stuff, but I have those shaped glasses also, so.
Well, you know, guys, I hate to say this, but we're out of our time here, but I did want to end with one last question for Caitlin. That is, if you were to get a MacArthur Genius Grant and you could work on anything that you wanted, what would be your next project?
Oh my gosh.
So many things, right?
So many things, yes. So one thing, this is also going back to the wizard activism and art and, you know, our passions and dreams that people have. And one thing that I hear a lot of my friends saying is that they've been so failed by, and this is also like a Harry Potter Dumbledore thing, but they're so failed by their education, in the sense of, you know, like what adulting is, right? Like the ability to be an adult. So there's
no, we don't know what that is.
Have you achieved it?
Please tell me that.
I wish I didn't know what it was.
So yeah, this whole thing about adulting and how, you know, we know all this fluff that we don't need to know and we don't know how to make it. And a lot of my friends and I as well, like, struggle with, you know, wanting to create art or pursue passions, but are, you know, encumbered by student debt, or we have healthcare issues or whatever. So an idea that I thought would be really cool was to make like an app that's targeted toward young people, that gives you like crash courses in these adulting topics. And then as you work your way through these courses, you earn points. And then if you get enough points, you can redeem them for mentoring hours with people who are successful in the field that you want to be in. So people don't have access to mentors or don't have access, you know, to these educational tools. Or, you know, if you're really young and you're not motivated to actually learn any of these things, like, I didn't care about what a 401k was until, you know, 6 months ago, basically. So, which is a huge oversight.
I know, you should really care about the 401k.
No, and my parents, I mean, that's the thing. My parents told me, like, you know, do your 401k, blah, blah, blah. My parents are busy. They don't have time to, like, drill this home to me every 10 seconds when I'm actually supposed to be adulting. So having this kind of, you know, reward system for people who don't have the tools to be adulting, or maybe not the motivation, like, it would work in two different ways. So to build this system that is not only a learning system, but also like a networking tool, and it has a reward at the end where you do get to speak to people who have been, you know, successful and can tell you exactly what they did and mistakes that they made. But it's supposed to be meant to target creatives, in general, and say, like, you know, you can, you know, work on your novel, why you get a job, but you should do these five things, try to get rid of your student debt, you know, have an effective resume and all that stuff, right? That people who have these barriers don't always have access to that information.
Yeah, and I love that this is a potential equalizer. You know, if it's an app that could be accessible as long as you have a phone, as opposed to what I think often happens, which is that people who know people or people who have connections with people are the ones who get that mentoring. But this would be a kind of avenue where, you know, people, you know, would be able to just anticipate that they would be able to get that mentoring once they reach a certain level of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there are, I mean, still a barrier. I can't remember the exact percentage, but it's like 30% of school-age American children don't have consistent access to the internet. It's like a really, it's a lot higher percentage than I thought it was going to be. It may even be higher than that. But then, like, I would love to do, you know, a partnership with schools where we would come into schools and, you know, have this accessible to kids in schools, or try to partner with teachers, because teachers often, I mean, I worked at an elementary school and we were getting iPads in the classroom and all that stuff. And I was like, I grew up with, you know, pen and paper. So having access in the classroom and trying to make sure that these kids get access to this information, because no one should be graduating from college, you know, not registered to vote, not knowing how to buy a car, you know, not knowing how to do their taxes, like that stuff that everyone has to do, that no one really learns unless someone grabs them by the ear and forces them to do it. So, yes, that would be my very expensive, long passion project that I know very little about.
That's an awesome idea. Everything starts at that. You know, it's the drawing board. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great idea. And I love that that combines, you know, the activism part with the art, with the creativity.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Well, thank you so much, Caitlin Elizabeth Harper, for being the podcast today and for helping us to dive deep into Quidditch as a way to understand the Harry Potter books at a new level. And I hope that that was as really enlightening to our listeners as it was to me. Wow, I think that, you know, I really saw things that I had not seen before based on what you were saying. Everybody be sure to check out Caitlin's young adult novel, It Will Set You Free. That also sounds wonderful. Thanks also to Emily Strand for serving as our resident expert for this show. And we hope to have you
pleasure.
On again, Emily. Thank you.
Yeah, I would love it. And I would just like to publicly thank Caitlin for following up on John's and my musings of hoping that somebody would investigate the Quidditch in all the books and how it looks at the plot and but our laziness of not wanting to do it ourselves. So I just want to publicly thanks a lot, Caitlin, for doing that.
Thank you for all the work you did before and chatting with me last year. And it was awesome. Awesome to have at least one other person who can even feign interest in Quidditch for me, for my benefit.
Who just gets the awkward cocktail party conversation when I am asked what it is that I write about. Well, I write about Quidditch.
Yep. I'm going to say, Emily, I have seen you talk about Quidditch at conferences, and you have had good-sized audiences. Come on, admit
shocking,
it. I think
right?
more people are interested in it than maybe. It maybe comes across. Maybe not in your immediate circle of friends, but...
maybe not, yeah. But I think that's the operative word there.
I think, yeah, it's a secret fan favorite. Everyone's over Snape, so they've moved on to Quidditch, right? Isn't that the way that it's going?
Really? I don't know. Snape's a big draw. Well, listeners, don't forget to stay tuned for John Granger's next online class in the Wizard Reading Formula. And John will be also back on the podcast in future episodes. I would like to give a big shout out to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you for all you do, Emma. We could not do this without you. And we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and that includes our new liaison to MuggleNet, Renee McBrien. Now, speaking of this, dear listeners, we are so glad you've joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Do you play Quidditch? And have thoughts for us on what it means to you and how that might connect to the book? Please share those thoughts, and you can do that in a private email through readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, or you can engage with us on Twitter, Read Write Roll, or on our Facebook page. Those last two would be good places to get a conversation going. We would love to see that. And listeners, I will now leave you with the wisdom of Hogwarts headmaster Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said in the foreword to Quidditch Through the Ages, "As we have developed the game of Quidditch, so it has developed us. Quidditch unites witches and wizards from all walks of life, bringing us together to share moments of exhilaration, triumph, and, for those who support the Chudley Canons, despair." Sorry, Ron. Poor Ron. But let's instead end our game on a more constructive note with my favorite Dumbledore quote, which is, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, where we'll be using our words to make some magic.